Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Well, it is a physical therapy day here today, and got our regular physical therapy experts to join in. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. Jill, a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program. Jill, good to see you again.
It's great to be here.
And Lori is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, great to have you with us.
It's good to be here. Awesome. It's a lovely day, a little windy, but I think we're seeing signs of spring, and people are going to be getting out and maybe hitting a tennis racket or out in the pickleball court or the
swinging a golf club.
Yep.
And so far today, none of us have a rotator cuff issue.
So far, so good. Exactly.
Speaking of rotator cuff issues, let's talk some basics of that before we get into it, Jill. Maybe a common source of shoulder pain. That
absolutely.
Older pain people experience.
Right.
What is a healthy rotator cuff look like?
Well, since we don't see them very often, don't think we know. No. So the rotator cuff pathology has become so common that it's actually considered part of the natural aging process. So to have some sort of wear and tear in your rotator cuff as you age is not that atypical. Now, there's a whole spectrum of what that can entail. It can entail just maybe a little bit of micro tears in the muscle, all the way through to a partial thickness tear, where you have a partial tear of the rotator cuff muscle or muscles, and then all the way to what we call a full thickness tear, where you have completely torn through one or more than one of the rotator cuff muscles.
And that's the acute one.
It can be acute, absolutely, from a fall or something like that. But you can also have people who have such bad wear and tear that they've completely torn through their rotator cuff muscle, unbeknownst to them. Some people are completely asymptomatic. So it's hard to correlate the size of the tear necessarily with people's pain, disability, and ability to function. They just don't necessarily always go together. Of the types of tears that exist, smaller tears, less than 50% of the tear of the muscle, are much more common than full thickness or large tears. So a lot of people are walking around with probably very small tears in the rotator cuff, whether they know it or not, whether they have symptoms or not.
Right, exactly. And so, as we age, if you did imaging for people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, the majority of them would have some level of rotator cuff tear or tendinopathy. Sometimes it's what we call an undersurface tear on the bottom side of the tendon. Sometimes, as Jill said, from wear and tear, even as a younger individual, but you're asymptomatic. And then all of a sudden you go out and you do something that's unusual that you haven't done before. So it's spring. Maybe you're out using a handsaw to trim your bushes. Or maybe you're doing other kinds of yard cleanup, or you've decided to go swing your tennis racket or your golf ball and you haven't picked it up in months. And then you overwork that tendon, and then you end up with what we call a tendinopathy or tendon pain. And, if it goes untreated and people end up going to the doctor or whatever, and they say, well, let's get imaging. And they say, oh, you've got a tear. People kind of go, oh, no, I've got a tear. But chances are that tear's been there a long time, right, and you just flared it.
Right.
Yeah. I pitched for many years.
Ah.
I was a pitcher, but I was also playing golf. I probably have some tears.
Oh, probably. But you function just fine, right?
Yeah, I don't have any pain.
You take very good care of your shoulders. You balance things out. You do play a lot of golf, but you also ramp that activity up probably a little bit reasonably.
Yeah. First time I just played 9 holes with my daughter.
There you go. Mm-hmm. That's a perfect example. The challenge is we have a nice, beautiful day, our first spring day, and everybody thinks they need to go out and play 18 holes of golf, or they need to clean up their entire yard and do all of their yard work in one day. Or my other thing, Larry, is you go to the driving range and you hit a bucket of balls with your driver, 75 balls in a bucket or 50, whatever. And that's not how you play golf at all. You swing your driver and then you walk a little bit and you swing a different club. And, you know, you don't hit 75 drives in a row like that. So there will be people who first nice day do that. And that's a huge increase in activity and demand on the shoulder after being relatively dormant all winter.
Right. And if it's your dominant shoulder, then stirring that pot, it self-perpetuates with your daily usage and your daily activities. So people want to know, well, why am I not getting better? Well, it's because you've disrupted that homeostasis. Like, you and your rotator cuff were in agreement about the level of activity that was going to happen, and all of a sudden you increased it and you stirred it up, and you can't just go back to your previous level of activity and have it be okay. Rotator cuff is still mad. And that's when you come and see us and we get you started on a good program to recover from that.
Do you ever recommend steroid injections?
So typically the first line of defense, and we can talk a little bit about this paper, the first line of defense is typically exercise, activity modification, exercise, whether it's strengthening of those muscles, like Lori alluded to, or many times physical therapists will take a step back and look more at the shoulder blade itself, the scapula, and make sure that your shoulder blade and your posterior shoulder muscles are sitting in a good place before we even worry about the rotator cuff, because that part of the ball and socket joint has to be seated appropriately for those little guys, the rotator cuff guys, to do their job. So in most cases, using exercise and manual therapy, perhaps with an oral anti-inflammatory, is probably the most logical way to go.
Right. And starting with the scapula is the base of support for your shoulder. Your shoulder is basically a golf ball sitting on a tee. It's not inherently stable. The stability comes from the scapula. So what this clinical practice guideline has showed us is that people who start with scapular and motor control exercises do better. So we don't always come right at the rotator cuff. You know, you sometimes, no matter what the issue is, you don't want to come right at it. You sort of want to circle around it and work your way in. So you work around that joint or around that problem, and you work on stabilizing, on motor control, on strengthening the surrounding, like circling your wagons, strengthening those things around it. And then as things improve, you gradually funnel in directly toward the rotator cuff or whatever tissue you're looking at.
And that was the research that was?
That was the research, yeah. Showed that working scapular stabilizers and motor control, and that is focusing on what muscles am I activating, what's my position, what's my posture, and so on. Those exercises were consistently successful in recovering from this.
And so along the lines that Lori's talking about, there are many times if I see someone with rotator cuff pathology in the very first few visits, I don't give them rotator cuff strengthening at all.
Right.
We're trying to fix those other things. And what I find is if you get those things seated better and they have a better length tension relationship between their scapula, their shoulder blade, and the humeral head, their rotator cuff can fire and actually perform really well. So in essence, what you're trying to do is get everything seated appropriately. And some people think you almost create more space for the rotator cuff to do their job if that scapula is seated appropriately. And then lo and behold, their rotator cuff actually feels tremendously better. And those rotator cuff strengthening exercises are actually easier to perform.
Exactly.
Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, Lori Tyne Brody, our guests. And, you know, I don't think I gave the phone number when I started. Let's do it right now. If you have a question or comment, maybe about your shoulder or your rotator cuff or maybe something else bothering you, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Just to follow up on that research, how did they arrive at this conclusion?
So they reviewed a large body of literature. And interestingly, this was not just a group from the United States. This was an international group from both Canada and Ireland. And they reviewed basically about every piece of literature that was written on rotator cuff tendinopathy. And they came up with, you know, what we would call levels of evidence. So they grade them from, you know, A to F, like really strong evidence for this, mixed evidence, strong evidence against, et cetera. And so they've come up with guidelines for what information should you gather in the history? What are the important factors? And one of the factors that came out was psychosocial factors, like what is your lifestyle like? What is your attitude toward your shoulder and so on? So it's not just specifically about a rotator cuff, but it's about how does this work for you in your life? So it's really important to gather that information because not everybody has the same demand on their shoulder. So everything from what do you get in the history? What are the most reliable and valid diagnostic techniques? Do you do imaging or do you not do imaging? What are the most helpful interventions? Do you do a corticosteroid injection? Do you take a nonsteroidal? What kinds of exercises are best? And what are the best ways to measure progress?
All good points. Stacy in Ashland has something I believe that relates to this. Let's go there. Hi, Stacy.
Good morning. My question is about the sling that they give after the shoulder surgery. My husband had the biceps muscle moved to a different area, and now the sling that he is wearing is causing problems in the scapula, which is now causing more problems in his shoulder.
Oh, dear. So just for the listeners, he had a what we call a biceps tenodesis, which is where they take off the long head of the biceps tendon, which attaches up at your scapula, that glenoid. It can many times be the driver of people's pain. And they just relocate it down into between the greater and lesser tuberosity of the humerus. So they move it a little bit, and so it has less jobs to do, basically. And so now his scapula is winging in the back, Stacy. Is that what the problem is?
Well, the strap that connects from the elbow around to the opposite shoulder, it goes right across the scapula. Now that part of his muscle is all swollen, and it's causing more problems in the area that he had surgery on.
Because the strap is rubbing, or
it's just putting pressure, constant pressure.
Okay.
On that.
So that's a really unusual complaint following this kind of surgery. So I would get in touch with the surgeon and let them know what's going on, because, you know, swelling in the scapular area doesn't make sense. So he had a biceps tenodesis. Did he have any other surgery at the same time?
They removed some bone spurs, and I think they removed part of the collarbone.
Oh, sure. So he
had a subacromial decompression. Yeah.
So but still.
Yeah, but still, I just want to make sure there wasn't anything we were missing.
Correct.
So if they had a suprascapular nerve release, that would have been right at the scapula. So I think you should get in touch with the surgeon and let the surgeon know this, because it sounds like your husband is spiraling the wrong direction.
Right.
So it may be creating secondary problems that you're going to have to unravel. So rather than waiting, I would get in touch with the surgeon and let them know what's going on and have them take a look, and they may recommend something different other than the sling that your husband has.
Right. Is he in a sling that has the little spacer that keeps his arm away from his side a little bit, Stacy, or is his arm straight down by his side?
His arm is straight down by his side.
So they may switch it out and put you in that solely because then one of the straps goes more around your waist. And so that may just position things a little bit different. So there are a couple different slings
out there. How long ago was his surgery?
3 weeks.
Oh, he shouldn't be in a sling anymore, generally.
Well.
At 3 weeks?
Yeah, probably not.
Yeah, I would get in touch with the surgeon because, at least here in our experience with a near Mumford, I wouldn't be in a sling at 3 weeks.
Has he started physical therapy?
Yes, he's been. I'm sitting outside physical therapy.
So I would definitely bring it up with a physical therapist while you're there and ask questions about how often your husband should be wearing the sling. Can he start weaning out of it? Is this a problem? Because you might you might be putting it in your rearview mirror if he's starting to wean out of it anyway. So run inside and ask him.
Yeah, and the physical therapist is somebody who has what we would call a little more history with the patient because they see them for longer periods of time and they've seen them change from visit to visit.
Yeah. Good luck, Stacy, and run in there right now.
Go ask him right now.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Our guests, Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, we're started by taking a look at rotator cuff tendinopathy, and now we're still on that, but taking other questions as well as we move along. And I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Jim in Appleton next. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I'm a little embarrassed to admit this in such a public forum, but I have torn both of my rotator cuffs, full thickness tears where I couldn't lift my arms. I did it a year apart, almost to the day, which my wife regularly points out. and I am grateful to my surgeon and to my physical therapist that I could recover from it. The work I did for money, a lot of it was overhead.
Oh, yeah.
Which apparently is kind of poison for shoulders, but
it can
they were able to fix me. And, you know, I worked in an era before ergonomics was even a word. And so now it would be different. But anyway, it's a recoverable injury. It takes a long time. And I'm lucky to live in an area of the world I could get it fixed.
So did you have bilateral rotator cuff repairs staged apart? Is that what I'm hearing?
A year apart, I had them done.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Lori.
Did you have an acute injury that you tore them, or was this the gradual progression from your overhead work?
No, this is the embarrassing part.
Oh,
The first one, I tripped on my dog.
Yep.
And fell. And the second one, I tripped. I was wearing yak tracks on my boots, and I discovered I could get one foot caught in the strap of the other one.
Oh!
Where I was shoveling snow.
Wow.
And that's all it took was just kind of tipping over mid-stride.
So these are virtually the straws that broke the camel's back. So years and years of wear and tear from this overhead activity probably left your rotator cuff vulnerable. And so a small mechanism of injury, these little trips and falls on an outstretched hand, we call them a foosh, was enough that with your history, it tore your rotator cuff. In somebody who doesn't have a history of rotator cuff wear and tear, it might be fine. Like my sister, for example, who fell off her bike and didn't hurt her rotator cuff. So, you're not alone in your mechanism of injury. I would definitely say we've heard stories like this, especially the trip over the dog. And you're not alone. And you're absolutely right. The length of rehab it takes, because as we age, these tendons degenerate. And so it's harder and harder to sew poor tendons back together. So that's part of the challenge with a rotator cuff repair is the quality of the tendon is a big factor that they have to sew together.
Right. Well, that's what I wondered. If he had degenerative tears, if the quality of his tendons was such that he was still able to have a repair.
Yeah.
Because could we talk about a repair versus just a clean out? You know, it sounds like Stacy's husband, they went in and they cleaned some things out, some bone spurs, took off the end of the clavicle, moved the biceps tendon, but didn't necessarily repair the rotator cuff. If they had, he would have been in one of the immobilizers that you described with the elbow away from the side. Either Stacy's husband's rotator cuff was intact or it didn't need to be repaired.
Jim, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. It's good to know that everything worked out.
Right.
Exactly. Yep.
Willem in Colfax, we'll go to you next. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I've been splitting wood every winter since 1977. So I was wondering, is that damaging to the shoulder? Like sometimes my shoulder is sore, but is that, you know, and I've gotten a lighter maul, splitting maul. It's like 8 pounds instead of the heavier ones. So I was just wondering about that.
Well, it, you know, as all things in life, and the students hate this, it depends.
Right.
So you've been doing it for a lot of years. You do it in the, do you do it in the winter, or you do it leading up to the winter? Is it a 12-month of the year activity?
No, I do it in the winter, you know, and when it's really super cold out, obviously I have to split more wood, but it's so I do it for, you know, from September till April probably.
Okay. So most of it depends upon the kind of shape your shoulders are in. So if for the rest of the year you're working with your arms, you're keeping your shoulders and your rotator cuff strong, you're probably fine. If you're somebody who sits at a desk and then gets up and starts swinging an axe for repetitively over and over, your rotator cuff isn't going to like it because it's too dramatic a change in your activity level. So, you know, if this is novel for you come winter, you have to work into it slowly so that you can convince your rotator cuff that this is an okay activity. So it's the change in activity level that's going to get you. It's the same thing we see in sports this time of year where people decide they're going to go out and they're going to run, you know, 5 miles, or they're going to go golf 18 holes when their body hasn't done that for months. Your body kind of goes into a little bit of a state of shock and something's going to rebel. So for you, as long as you're maintaining your upper body strength, maybe doing some resistive training the rest of the year, and then working into your wood splitting gradually so you and your rotator cuff can be in agreement on the activity, then you're probably okay.
Yeah.
There you go, Willem. Thank you very much for calling. Dave and DePeer couldn't stay with us, but had reverse shoulder replacement.
Oh, yeah.
As a we just lost it. Anyway, he had
a reverse total shoulder replacement
as a result of a rotator cuff tear.
Yes.
And he couldn't. Mm-hmm. And he can't keep from shrugging.
Oh yeah, yeah. Classic. Well, trying to elevate his shoulder, he's shrugging instead of raising his arm. He doesn't have the scapular stability.
So yes, so. For our listeners, if you have a massive rotator cuff pathology, one of the things that you can have done is called a reverse total shoulder, and they change kind of the orientation of the ball and socket joint. And so, as Laurie alluded to, you don't have to have a rotator cuff for this. One of the things you do have to have is a really strong deltoid. So it would change what muscles he needs to use and how he needs to use them a little bit. So I'm sure he's seen a physical therapist, but he might need to go back and get better neuromuscular retraining and control to make sure he's using these muscles that need to be used in a different way correctly.
Right. So one of the things this clinical practice guideline emphasized was motor control exercises mm-hmm. and neuromuscular rehabilitation. So one of the things that people who lack a rotator cuff do, and we don't know how long Dave was without his rotator cuff before he had his shoulder replacement, but one of the ways you get your arm up or elevate your arm is by shrugging your shoulders. And so that gets to be a habit. And now he's had surgery and potentially he's unable to break that habit of shrugging his shoulder to get his arm overhead. That requires a lot of work with the physical therapist mm-hmm. and neuromuscular training to stabilize at the scapula and to use the deltoid instead to raise the arm rather than shrugging the shoulder. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty common thing we see.
Boy. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Someone else was wondering about prevention. How do you prevent?
Well, I can speak to that.
Yes, Lori can speak to that.
I can speak to that because 3 weeks ago, I hit black ice on my bike, and I crashed, and I landed on my hip and shoulder. I landed direct impact on my shoulder, which should have, by all rights, resulted in a rotator cuff tear in my age group.
And it was your dominant shoulder.
And it was my dominant shoulder, which I use all day long at work. But, you know, in the past couple of years, I have been really diligent about weightlifting 3 times a week, and I do very specific rotator cuff exercises. I fully expected to wake up the next day in a lot of pain. I had zero shoulder pain, zero. And that, you know, I think it's because of the strengthening. Mm-hmm. So a good strengthening program for your rotator cuff is really important. There are a number of different exercises that work the different muscles of your rotator cuff, and a physical therapist, a meeting or two with the physical therapist, if you're concerned about this, they can give you some specific exercises to do.
And I think that's important, because if you go to a gym or a health club and you look at the wall and they say, oh, these are the good 8 exercises you should do if you're starting a weight training program or a resistance training program, rotator cuff strengthening is not part of that. They kind of strengthen, for lack of better terms, what we call the beach muscles. So the big muscles on the outside, your pecs and your lats. And those are very important, but they don't typically have a specific rotator cuff exercise for you.
And the other thing I'll say about the beach exercises is your rotator cuff is working concurrently to stabilize your shoulder,
right,
while you're doing that bench press or that push-up. And so what happens is, as people increase the weight on, for example, their bench press, they overwork their rotator cuff and they end up with rotator cuff tendinopathy, because they are not concurrently isolating and strengthening their rotator cuff, which is also working to stabilize, as they increase the weight of that bench press.
It's a muscle imbalance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Let's go to David in Monona next. Hi, David.
Larry, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I hear working on something in the basement, and I hear this discussion of rotator cuff. Well, I started playing ball about a year and a half ago, maybe a little longer, and I've been playing regularly. So we go to Florida for our camping trip, and I wait about 4 weeks, and I'm at a pickleball court, and within the first 30 seconds of playing, I crash. And
oh.
I'm not even sure what happened. I wasn't diving. I wasn't running backwards. But suddenly, I'm picking myself off the ground and pushing away from a fence that I crashed into. And my right arm, the guy says, can you play? I went to move my arm and said, ooh, no way. My bicep cramped and slammed my arm down to the side. I went to the ER, and they said no broken bones from the x-ray, but you should see an orthopedic. Well, I waited till I came back to Madison about a month later, and I'm with the VA, and I've got a PT scheduled tomorrow. I got an orthopedic consult in April. I have an MRI that's been accomplished. It shows a full tear and a partial tear. And now I'm living with it, thinking, I'm going to go play pickleball with my left hand.
Of course you're thinking that.
And you did?
No, don't do it.
No, don't do it. No,
exactly.
I agree.
Exactly, yeah.
So it sounds like, you know, this fall that you experienced resulted with maybe in a tear. The tear could have been pre-existing. We're unsure. But regardless of which came first, starting with physical therapy is a really good idea. Let's see how much you can function in this condition. There are many people who can function with a full thickness rotator cuff tear and get along just fine. So again, you have a full thickness tear and a partial thickness tear. So let's do some conservative care first and see what mm-hmm. happens and see how things shake out. So I actually think it's really good you're starting with physical therapy first and then seeing the ortho, because you can then you have an update to provide the ortho that, hey, I'm getting better with this physical therapy and I think I'm on the right path.
Exactly. And we don't know which muscles have a full thickness tear and which have a partial. If he's got a full thickness of the long head of his biceps and
he
mentioned something about the biceps, doesn't matter.
Who cares?
You can function just fine without that. And then if the rotator cuff is a partial tear, probably going to be just fine.
Right.
So we just don't know at this point. But in any case, physical therapy is absolutely the first step.
Mm-hmm.
So go to your appointment and see how far you can get. But
your rehab. Be compliant.
Yep. It's a great classic story.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Thanks, David, for calling. Peter in Madison, your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hello. I'm calling in regards to my shoulders. I don't have rotator cuff problem, but I have bone on bone on both shoulders. I've been told I could go through a shoulder replacement, but at 80 years old, I'm reluctant to do that. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I think this gets back to the very important question that this paper alluded to, and how does this impact your life, Peter? So can you function? Can you do the things you want to do? Is your pain limiting you from doing things? Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because just because you have bone on bone on your imaging doesn't tell us anything about how this is impacting your life.
Are you in pain, Peter?
Yeah. How's your pain?
I am in pain when I try to go put on a T-shirt or a sweatshirt on my left shoulder quite a bit. I put arthritic cream on it daily.
Okay.
But I'm fully functional. But as I said, at 80 years old, I'm reluctant to have a shoulder replacement.
Well, and again, some of it comes down to your general health.
Right.
What are your risks in a surgical procedure? So people who have what we call comorbidities, whether it's heart disease, diabetes, any other medical issues that might put them at risk in a shoulder surgery or any surgery, we certainly take that into account. If you have pain as you're like reaching to put your shirt on, but then after you get it on, your pain goes away, that could be an acceptable level of pain for you to be able to function in your life. So it always comes down to that sort of risk cost benefit analysis in terms of your overall health, your function and pain. So generally what we say about any joint replacement is the time to get it done is when the bad days are winning.
Right.
When you have so much pain that you are unable to function.
I was thinking about my father-in-law who was well into his 80s and had hip replacement surgery.
Our mother had a knee replacement in her 80s.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
So age
but it
is,
all depends.
Right.
Exactly.
Age is only a factor when it comes to your comorbidities and your general health and your ability to successfully undergo a surgery and the rehabilitation.
Lori, what about the pool for Peter since he's got this bilateral shoulder pain? What do you think about it? I know we talk about it for the lower extremity a lot because it unloads those joints and things like that. It's a little trickier for the shoulder.
So actually it's good for the shoulder because upward motions are what tend to be painful for people with shoulder problems, and anything moving upward in the pool is buoyancy assisted. So, you know, is it going to decrease his pain? Well, if he's not having pain at rest, don't know. You know, we could do some strengthening down low, but in terms of working overhead, that's not something we would do there anyway.
Right.
So, again, it comes down to how much of an issue is this, and how is there a way we can improve your strength? Would improving your strength improve your function and decrease your pain? So that's the question.
Yeah. Peter, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Kevin in La Crosse, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm just kind of curious about something. I first dislocated my right shoulder when I was 18 or 19, and I'm 63 now. Now, I haven't dislocated for a while, but I'm able to put it back in myself.
Nice.
So,
great.
Yeah.
But can he get PT for that? Should he?
You absolutely can. So let's just back up and talk a little bit about how times have changed. So Kevin had his first dislocation when he was 18. If you dislocate now when you're 18, you're more than likely going to have surgery to stabilize it because we don't want somebody to become a recurrent dislocator like Kevin is because we know that that puts you on the path to degenerative arthritis. So hopefully over time there are less and less Kevins out there that know how to put their own shoulder in. But I would definitely try a course of physical therapy to strengthen some of the rotator cuff muscles and see if we can get him a little bit more stable. How, Kevin, and what things are you doing when your shoulder comes out?
Well, it hasn't happened for a while. When I was one time it came out when I was just laying in bed and I stretched.
Yep, not uncommon. Yep.
And then another time was when I doing something more physical. I was working up in the Boundary Waters at a crew outfitter, and I was picking up a canoe, and I was too far ahead, and the weight took me back, and I just pulled my arm back, and it popped out.
Yep. Yeah. Well, those are fairly typical mechanisms for people who have recurrent instability. So, again, we come back to that cost benefit. Does it happen often enough for you to get some physical therapy and see about strengthening? I actually don't think it's as much about strengthening as it is about neuromuscular control, right, of you being aware of activating the muscles that will stabilize the humeral head and the glenoid that will keep your shoulder in place when you're reaching or stretching overhead. So it's more of a motor control program than actually strengthening.
Right.
There you go, Kevin. Thank you so much for calling. Connie in Madison, your turn. Hi, Connie.
Oh, good. I am so glad to talk to you. I just need your help so bad. I'll tell you, I'm 80, and the parts are a-going. So I've had a knee replaced, should do the other back surgery. But now I keep falling down because my bad knees. Did a backward somersault down a flight of stairs most recently, and I re-broke my collarbone, redid my shoulder. And the triage now says at UW that I'm beyond shoulder replacement because of my osteoporosis and severe arthritis. So what can I do? I mean, I try to do isometrics, and all of the slings and that just made it worse, pulling it out of the socket. And so, yeah.
So the pool would be a really good place for you to work, partly because of the multiple things you have going on. You have the knee, you have the back, you have the shoulder and the clavicle, all that. So everything underwater gets resisted as you move through the water. So you can do strengthening for your upper body. We have some lovely things that we do for upper body strengthening in the pool that can be supported by water's buoyancy. But also we're unloading your knees at the same time and strengthening your lower extremity muscles, strengthening your core, your hip, your back, all of which will help you. And we work a lot of those things, the way we design them, if we design them correctly, we're also training your balance, which is going to be really important for you, it sounds like, who fell down the stairs backwards.
Right. The only downside is this won't address the issue of osteoporosis as much as a land-based exercise would, but that's okay.
Right.
Because this is still a way better return on your investment, Connie, to get in and do some pool rehab.
And sometimes when we start in the pool, we get you to a point where you can then transition to a land exercise program, but early on, land is too much for you.
Right. And like Lori said, you can strengthen multiple things at once because of the water's viscosity once with everything Connie has going on. That sounds great.
Makes perfect sense to me. Connie, can you get yourself to a pool?
Sure. Okay.
Well, I know about the knee and back things because I've had those for years. It's the shoulder now that the pain is so bad, and I try to do isometrics and try to hold it back in the socket and sleep kind of sideways on an angle to push it back during the night. I just didn't know if there's any other things I can do, because I can lift my hand to my elbow, but nothing above the elbow can I do.
So have you been to physical therapy for this?
Not for the shoulder.
So that might be a good place to start, because they can talk to you about strategies for sleeping, strategies for moving, dressing, etc. And then they can also refer you to the pool for additional exercise there.
Yeah, that makes really good sense. Connie, thank you so much for calling. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guest today as we talk physical therapy. And I am Larry Mueller, and you are listening to WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk physical therapy with our guests from the UW, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. Let's go to Jim in Evansville next. Jim, thank you for calling.
Yes. I've been getting injections in my shoulder for arthritis for the, I bet it's been close to 10 years. Originally, the shot would last for 6 months. Now it's getting to be where I have to go in every 3 months, and I'm wondering if there's any collateral damage from... I also get shots in my knees, and one peculiar thing that happens, I got a shot in my shoulder, and my knees felt better.
Well, that tells you about the systemic effects of a local injection. I assume you're getting steroid?
Corticosteroid?
I believe so, and it's a guided injection.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so they probably do corticosteroid with a little bit of lidocaine, mm-hmm. and it's ultrasound guided. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So yes, there are long term effects of intra-articular within the joint corticosteroid injections, because that blast of corticosteroid does positive things, but it also can eat away at your articular cartilage or kind of wear, causing it. It's almost like an accelerant for a fire. I can visualize my dad standing by the barbecue and taking that wizard charcoal lighter and squirting it and making those big flames come up.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I think about a corticosteroid does for wear and tear on the articular cartilage.
Yeah.
It can cause an accelerant.
So 10 years, that's a really long time to be getting steroid injections.
Every 6 months.
Every three to six months.
Three to 6 months.
Do you have a diagnosis?
Well, just that there's arthritis in that area.
Okay. Have you been to physical therapy?
I really haven't, no.
Well, I'd probably give that a shot. So,
pun intended.
Pardon the pun. Yeah, sorry, it's a Monday. Go to physical therapy. The 10 years of ongoing shots for this, for arthritis. May I ask your age, Jim?
80.
Okay, all right. So 10 years. All right. I would go to physical therapy and see if you can get on a strengthening program to offload. So sometimes people say, I have arthritis in my knees. How is it that therapy is going to change that? Therapy doesn't change the arthritis. There's not a lot of correlation between what we see on imaging in terms of arthritis and people's pain and function. I've looked at enough images over the last 40 years to tell you that relationship is poor.
Right.
So physical therapy helps strengthen the muscles around the joint so the muscles can offload the joint. What we see often in people is the mechanics of how they use their joints is very inefficient. They're not using the muscles to offload the joint. Instead, they rely on the joint static structure to carry the load, and that advances your arthritis, it overloads the joint. So often by strengthening the muscles around the joint, we can offload the joint and take some of the pressure off those arthritic joints. So PT would be a good strategy.
Yeah.
And along those lines, I'm going to share a text message I got from a listener who also does handiwork around my house. He said, I had given him some strengthening advice for his knee. He's got osteoarthritis in his knee. And he said, since I've been doing the exercises at the gym, inflammation is down markedly. I'm taking fewer anti-inflammatories. I don't wear the compression sleeve. And things are just better. So this is a perfect example of he didn't change his arthritis, but he changed the things around his joint that made them better.
Made him better. Jim, mm-hmm. there you go. Appreciate your call very much. Let's go to another Jim in Stevens Point this time. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I have a question about shoulder replacement surgery. I had a chronically dislocated shoulder here in the mid-90s. I'm 70 now, and I'm starting to have pain in that shoulder. I did see an orthopedic who said, well, in addition to arthritic conditions, you also have some cartilage that's wearing in and around that repair. So then I went into physical therapy, and after going through that, I went to the gym, and I'm going to the gym now with different exercises that he gave me. I'm aware of the reversible, I believe it's called, shoulder replacement surgery. But I was also told that there's something called a stemless. And I'm curious, your guest could talk about Edith.
Oh, we broke up there a bit. What did you say? Did you hear the therapy?
I think it was a question about just an anatomic total shoulder replacement versus a reverse total shoulder replacement. And then he was asking about a stemless replacement.
Okay.
So I'm wondering if the stemless replacement is just the humeral head resurfacing, if that's
Could
what
be.
He's talking
it
about.
It might be, yeah.
So one of the options you can have done is literally it's called a humeral head resurfacing, and they basically just put a little, it's like a
cap.
little hat, a little baseball cap on the humeral head. And so that articulates with your glenoid, the socket joint, and then you don't have to have a full total shoulder replacement. That's probably the lowest hanging fruit. And then the other option is if you have a total shoulder replacement, you can have an anatomic total shoulder replacement where they replace the ball, and then you have a stem that goes down your humerus, and they also replace the socket, which is what he's referring to, I think. And then you can have a reverse total shoulder where they make the socket kind of like a ball and your humeral head kind of curved in. So that's the reverse total shoulder.
So
the outcomes, I can tell you.
Yeah,
wow. So the outcomes for an anatomical total shoulder and a reverse total shoulder are not that different. Patient selection plays a huge role. So what we know is that for people with rotator cuff arthropathy who have, you know, a history of degenerative tears, awful tears, things like that, the reverse total shoulder will be better for them because they don't need a rotator cuff. So the people who have an anatomical total shoulder replacement have to have a healthy rotator cuff. And as we know, as people age, they don't have those as much. So I think the reverse total shoulder is getting more popular, but it has to do with criteria for the surgeries.
Right. And I think
is that what you were going to say?
Yeah. Well, I was going to say the little hat thing, I think, is, you know, we've taken a page from the hip.
Yes.
Where they did that resurfacing rather than doing a total hip
Correct.
Replacement. And so now they're trying that at the shoulder. It's newer as a procedure than the traditional or the reverse total shoulder.
So what would you do?
Me personally? Well, first of all, I have a gorgeous rotator cuff. So
really?
I do. So I'm hoping I never have any of these things. If I had a rotten rotator cuff, I would have a reverse total shoulder. The outcomes are good. People feel if I'm truly limited in life by pain.
Right.
Because the outcomes of the reverse total shoulder are good. People can move their head or move their hand overhead. They can function well. They get rid of their pain, and you don't have to worry about the rotator cuff. What you do have to do is make the deltoid really strong, which a lot of people have neglected over the years because we've been so darn worried about the rotator cuff.
Right. So Jim's history was that of chronic dislocation,
right.
It sounds like. So we don't really know anything about the status of his rotator cuff. So it would be a decision between he and the surgeon based upon what they see on imaging.
Right. His glenoid may be pretty worn out that he's not a candidate for the little humeral head resurfacing because his glenoid needs to be replaced
right.
as well.
Yeah.
Then he'd have an anatomical total shoulder.
Right. The glenoid gets beat up from the recurrent dislocations.
Correct.
Coming up to time here before our news break, but someone's wondering about why isn't rhizotomy recommended for people who can't have surgery?
A dorsal rhizotomy?
So, again, that's something between the patient and the physician. There are a number of factors that they look at in terms of the anatomy of the area, the amount of stenosis. They typically try injections first, and if the injections are not successful, then the rhizotomy may not be effective.
And I also thought the first reason you do a rhizotomy is because of spasticity. I always thought of it as a treatment procedure, for example, in people with cerebral palsy, things like that, to reduce spasticity, which I don't think of as something that's as common at the shoulder.
Right, right. No.
So,
I'm not sure the context of that question. It's a little hard to say based upon that question.
Yeah.
So,
well, we'll take up some other questions in just a few minutes with our guests, Lori Tyne Brody and Jill Tyne Nissenbaum. We've got news coming up next, and just a quick reminder, we'll be revisiting our conversation about the use and future of artificial intelligence in healthcare at 12:30 today. But for now, you've got Lori and Jill for the next half hour. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news. It's another physical therapy day here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guests, physical therapists Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. Jill's a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program, and Lori, a physical therapist and at the UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lots of callers online, so let's go to the phones. David in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I just want to make one comment first. I've had four joint replacements, and I've had most of my physical therapy done at UW, and I really like the staff there. I really appreciate the work they've done with me. I've gotten really good results.
Nice.
A couple of things I'd like to ask about is with all those replacements, my right shoulder, I've had the left one replaced last September. And the right one it was also diagnosed as having pretty nasty arthritis. And it's been bothering me quite a bit, and it's caused some nerve impingement, which occasionally causes most of my right arm to go numb. I'm thinking about having steroid injection done. I've had it done in the past. I'm just wondering, I know it's just kind of a placeholder, but what else can I do, and how long should I rely on this sort of injection therapy before I just have to bite the bullet? I was listening earlier, and like I said, I've been around this bend several times in terms of replacements. It gets to the point where it just doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have it fixed.
Right.
But knowing what the steroids do. I'm just kind of concerned that if I just do it too often and too long, it's just going to contribute to things getting worse instead of just helping me get over the short-term pain.
Right. Well, I think the first thing I would think about with your right shoulder is, are you sure this is coming from your shoulder? Because anytime we talk about kind of radicular symptoms that go down your arm, I would be a little more suspicious of your cervical spine. So are you sure this is coming from your shoulder, or has anybody done an evaluation examination of your neck?
Yeah, when I first had the problem get really severe, I would wake up in the middle of the night, and like I said, the whole arm from the shoulder all the way down to my hand would be numb.
Okay.
And the entire hand would be numb.
Okay.
And I went into my GP at the time, and they referred me to orthopedics, and we did a cervical imaging study, and it seems that the problem is more coming out of the shoulder. It's okay. A case of if I press my back against the surface in a certain way for very long, then the pain is exacerbated, and I start getting numbness.
So a thoracic outlet potentially, because. In anything that's primary shoulder will affect you from the elbow down. Anything above the elbow is, you know, the company line is that cervical, unless it's thoracic outlet. So that his comment about pushing his shoulder back against a surface makes me think it could be a thoracic outlet problem.
Oh, I was thinking a suprascapular nerve entrapment.
Yeah, but suprascapular nerve wouldn't give him numbness all the way down his arm. Right?
No, although I think the suprascapular muscle. Well, no, never mind.
Okay.
I was thinking of trigger point. Never mind.
Okay. So have you been to physical therapy for this?
Yeah, you know all those PTs. You've
right,
been
exactly.
around a couple times, David, mm-hmm. unfortunately.
We did some work.
Okay.
I was given a short-term course of fairly high dose. I can't remember how many milligrams. It was more than 20. But it was like multiple pills.
Like a dose pack.
Yeah, it was a dose pack.
Yeah, right, right. So so the imaging they did they do an MRI, plain films?
It was plain films.
Okay. So in my world, plain films does not rule out a primary neck problem. So
I would see the physical therapist.
I would go to physical therapist because what they do is a very thorough examination to determine the source of your symptoms.
Right.
So I would go request a referral to physical therapy. So to me, plain radiographs, not enough to rule out a primary neck problem. Not at all.
And the last thing you would hate to do is do a corticosteroid in that shoulder and have it do absolutely nothing for your radicular symptoms because the source of your symptoms is elsewhere, and then you still get kind of all the wear and the negative side effects of the corticosteroid without getting any benefits.
Yeah.
So I'd see a PT, have them do a really good, as Lori would say, stem to stern examination with your cervical spine and see what happens.
And since you're in UW and you've been through that system, I would see somebody in spine, someone who does spine. They can also do peripheral joints, but they have a lot of spine experience.
Yeah.
There you go, David. Thank you very much for calling.
I think that was the third David we've had today.
I was just going to say, we've got two Jims and three Davids. No, three Jims and three Davids.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, let's try Susan on for size.
Perfect.
Susan and DePere, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello, good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I had a, I don't know what the name of it was, but I had a lot of pain in my shoulder, and for 2 years was receiving cortisone injections every 3 months, and it just got worse. So I did have an MRI, and the doctor thought it was a rotator cuff tear. So when we went into, or he went into surgery, he found that my upper bicep tendons were shredded. Those were his words, shredded. And there was just a few little strands still holding on to the humerus.
Mm-hmm.
So they removed those and sanded off the burrs, installed four anchors, and used this cord-like material to connect them all again so I'd have some range of motion. But I'm just wondering about the torn. I first initially went in there because I thought I had a sore shoulder from lifting my parents' walkers and putting them in the back because he said it probably was from some unnatural movement. But then it just got worse and worse. And as bad as it was, he was a little stumped too. But I looked online on several different places. And it said that cortisone can break down tendon material. And I was just curious what your guests thought about that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's a word? Yes.
That's exactly what we were talking about earlier when you have to consider the frequency of corticosteroid injections. We had a caller that had called in, and similar to you, Susan had them every 3 to 6 months. And so, yes, the corticosteroid helps manage pain, but it does cause wear and tear on tendons and articular cartilage. And so it's not without negative impact, especially if it's what we call intra-articular in the joint.
Right, exactly. So are you better since your surgery?
I don't have the pain, but I don't have the range of motion at all.
Mm-hmm. Did you go to physical therapy after your surgery?
I did, and I did for about 6 months, and I had one of those, slings that put your arm at a 45-degree angle.
Airplane
and,
splint.
You know, that slowly got further down. But and I was very religious about it because I had friends that had shoulder surgery, and they all said, well, they didn't follow physical therapy, so I was going to do that. And it's just never gotten all the way back. So I don't know, if it will or if I should go back to physical therapy. But
it's, that's a really good question, Susan.
Is.
So as things change over time, I think it's sometimes useful to go back and do a tune-up. And there is some research on going back periodically for a tune-up of your home exercise program as you get stronger, as your range of motion changes, as your activity level changes, and get your program revised. So, assuming that whatever you were doing for your exercise program previously is still the correct one for you, may not be the case. So going back for one or two visits to retune things and see where things are now and what are your needs now today could be very different from what they were when you were discharged from therapy. So yeah. I think that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. Makes good sense. Susan, thank you very much for calling. Shelley in Hayward, on to you now. Hi, Shelley.
Hi. So I have a question on the use of vibration plates. I have a hip replacement. I have a friend who suggested I use this, and she thought it was good for lymphatic drainage and good for your body and building toning. And I'm hearing now that possibly if you've had a hip or knee replacement, you should not be using these. And I'm curious what your feelings are on using these, this type of equipment at all.
So what was the purpose for you? Why did you think you needed to do this?
Well, it gets really cold up here, and I wasn't active as much, and she said it was just good for toning and keeping your muscles.
Yeah, no, not that. So if you had some other rationale for using it, like someone told me it was good for pain control, mm-hmm. and when I get on it, I feel better when I'm done, I'd say, okay, it is not a replacement for exercise. It does not tone or build strength to the best of our knowledge.
Right. I'm wondering if they told them to go to steer away from them with total joints, if they were concerned about joint loosening, if they mm-hmm. were uncemented or something like
right,
that.
Right, right. Yeah, that could be. So that could be it.
So what should Shelley be doing? And Hayward's cold.
Well, yeah, it is.
Right, right. So I'm certain you have a home exercise program from your physical therapist mm-hmm. after your surgery. I don't know what the facilities are in Hayward, but if you need a place to walk, then you kind of need a gym, you know, or a treadmill or what? Yeah. Jill's rolling her eyes.
I was thinking about if there was a high school, then they can walk the halls in the high school or something like that.
Or but a mall. An indoor facility, yeah.
I'm not sure. The Hayward Hospital, there's a Hayward Hospital.
Yep.
Might be something there.
Yeah,
as
maybe
well.
We should open a gym there.
Yeah,
Jill.
That'd be great.
So,
I'd love it. But
finding a place where you can exercise. If you live in a place where it's winter for 6 months out of the year, you have to figure out how to exercise, because not only with the joint replacement, but for your general health,
right?
Like, you need to be exercising. American College of Sports Medicine says minimum 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
5 days a week of exercise. That includes cardio, balance, flexibility, and strength, mm-hmm. all those things. And, you know, we've seen this. We see it in our patients. We see it in ourselves. These are really important things to take note of. And so if you live someplace where you can't be outside doing those things, you got to figure out a place to do them.
Right, exactly.
I think there is an anytime.
Anytime fitness.
All right.
That works.
In Hayward.
Yeah, that works.
Yeah. That would do it.
Yeah,
Shelley,
correct.
Good luck with
that. Yeah, that'd be
a
choice better than the vibration plate.
Agreed. Because there's more things you can do actively versus mm-hmm. a passive intervention.
Yep.
Nathan from Little Chute emailed to remind listeners of the importance of proper stretching and warming up prior to any strenuous activities.
Mm-hmm. You warm up to stretch. You don't stretch to warm up.
Mm-hmm.
So the muscles and your tendons and joints need blood flow and circulation before you want to go into that stretching mode. So doing, you know, 5 minutes on the bike or a little bit of walking, things like that prior to stretching is a very good strategy. So I'm glad he brought that up.
Mm-hmm.
And Michelle emailed to ask if the rotator cuff is a group of muscles, a tendon, a ligament, or all three.
Two of the three.
Yeah, two out of the three. So any muscle that you have, it's always a muscle tendon unit. So you have the belly of the muscle, and then it attaches to a tendon. The tendon attaches to a bone. So you have all those. And most of the time for rotator cuff, the problem is with the tendon, not with the muscle belly itself. So, and anytime you go through a transition, for those mechanical engineers out there,
mm-hmm.
anytime you transition from one material type to another, such as muscle to tendon or tendon to bone, those are areas that are at an increased risk for problems because of the transition zones.
The other problem with the shoulder is there's so little space for these tendons, and we also have a subacromial bursa there. There's bone on top and bone on the bottom. So the smallest amount of error, margin of error, whether it's a bursitis where the bursa becomes enlarged. It can rub on the tendons and irritate it. Bony arthritic changes, some spurring on your acromion can actually decrease that space as well. So not only do we have the transition, the materials transition, it is transitioning in an area of your shoulder where there's so little space and such a small margin of error that that becomes complicated. And Lori Yett is going to say one more thing.
But wait,
there's more.
Exactly. The supraspinatus tendon, which is one of the primary stabilizers at your shoulder, one of the rotator cuff brothers or sisters, has a watershed area.
Yes.
So when the arm is down at your side, there's an area of the rotator cuff tendon that has no blood supply. That's, you can imagine it being torqued over the top of the ball of the shoulder. So that's why when, if you have a rotator cuff repair, you are immobilized with your elbow away from your side, because when it's down by your side, you have this watershed area where the rotator cuff tendon isn't getting any blood supply.
And Jeff let us know that in Hayward, there is the Northwoods Physical Therapy and Fitness Center providing the Hayward, Wisconsin area with outpatient physical therapy and public, and it has a public fitness center.
That's awesome.
Oh, I love that.
Me too.
I love that.
Northwoods Gym.
All right. Thank you.
Roger in Grantsburg, your turn. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. Good.
Got the call back here. I'm the guy that called before and told them these are the gals that still rock. if you remember that call, and I've talked to you about my ankle before, I was the one that fell off the Kiss Fuse in 1976 and broke my ankle.
Okay.
I'm still having problems.
Okay, what kind of problems?
My question is, now, I did tear up my rotator cuff here a couple of years ago. I fell backwards on the ground. I tripped and fell backwards and landed on my elbow, on my right elbow, and tore my shoulder all up. And I'm on some medication that I'm trying to. I've just found out now that it has a side effect with everything that I'm on. And I don't know if you have any idea about it. It's amiodarone. And I'm trying to get off of it, and because it has side effects with every medication that I'm on has some adverse side effect, and it had for like joints and ankles and whatever else it said about joint pain and joint problems, and can lead to my stability is really bad. It's made I don't feel very sure on my feet. You know, I'm afraid I'm going to fall down. And that could be part of why I did the dive and tore my shoulder up in the first place. But I was wondering if you knew of anything about any other side effects that medication, if you knew anything about it.
Okay.
Well, that's a pretty important medication, Roger. It is used to treat life-threatening heart rhythm problems, so I probably wouldn't trade some shoulder pain for that medication. So, in general, if you're having issues with medications and side effects,
right.
Two choices, or both of them, talk to your pharmacist because they're the experts
right.
on that. Talk to your physician, whoever prescribed this medication, and talk to those two people who can really fill things in for you and make recommendations and maybe suggestions of an alternative. But do not stop that medication.
Right. And let them know what your symptoms and complaints are. So you're having some joint pain, some muscle pain, and then this balance issue, which is a very large concern, because Roger's already sustained one fall and injured his rotator cuff, and we certainly don't want him to be at another falls risk.
Exactly.
And, so,
and it may be this medication itself, or it may be a combination and interaction. Yes, the cocktail of everything you're taking. So again, primary care physician. What we see sometimes happen with patients is they see the cardiologist, they see the rheumatologist, they see the orthopedist, the GP, and everybody orders something, but there's not anyone like in the big picture saying, ooh, you probably shouldn't be taking this one with that one. That's where a good pharmacist can come in and help you understand what kind of interactions there are, especially if you have multiple providers prescribing different medications and they may not always be talking to each other.
Right? Yeah. Roger, thanks again. Let's go to John in Carlsville. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I called in the last time and talked to these ladies, and they told me to go and get a physical therapist. I've been to one. I've had two office visits already, and I can feel it getting better already in my back. So just wanted to say thank you very much.
Oh, good. Glad to hear it.
I'm glad you found a good PT.
Yes, and make sure you continue to be compliant and don't fall off the rehab wagon once you start feeling good. We see that happen sometimes. I start feeling better, and so I start kind of moving away from my exercises and try to make it a habit, John.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep, so you John, can always stay tuned up.
Yeah, thank you so much. And Sarah emailed to ask about exercises to help reduce pain related to knee arthritis. What exercises also help people with an arthritic thumb joint?
Oh, yeah, we can talk about CMC arthritis, carpal metacarpal arthritis. That's the one in the thumb. And your thumb is 70% of your hand function, Sarah, so you use it a lot. There are different exercises you can do. There's a splint that can be made for you. The person I would see if I had CMC arthritis would be a certified hand therapist, and it could be a PT or it could also be an occupational therapist, but they really specialize in this. And arthritis at that joint, it's more common in women. We know as we use that hand, it just gets very arthritic. So splinting is a really common one. Some grip strengthening is good, some mobility exercises, but to see a certified hand therapist would be right. The way to go. And we both chuckled because our mom had surgery on hers because mm-hmm. she had bad OA there. Yeah.
So the thumb is bad.
The thumb is bad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So getting therapy, and they can talk about proper tools to use as well.
Ergonomic tools that can help you. Yep. And you can buy different things that have different grip sizes because the gripping of something may bother your thumb. So sometimes a wider grip works better. And so a certified hand therapist would be the person to help with that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Get in to see them before it gets bad or you'll end up like our mother with
surgery. Yep.
And we don't want that. No. Well, here we are out of time. I want to thank you both very much for taking time to be with us today. It's always a pleasure.
We had great questions today.
Listeners.
All the days, the gyms, the women whose names start with S.
Right. It was lots of really good questions. Yep. And you always bring good listeners, always have good listeners, and they share ideas. So it's always
enjoyable.
Yeah,
we learn a lot from them as well.
Absolutely.
Well, we learn a lot from you. Thank you both very much. Lori Tyne Brody is a physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, a professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW-Madison. It's great to have them with us, and we'll do it again with them in probably almost exactly 1 month from now. Oh, just a quick mention, tomorrow at this time, Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals will be with us to talk about your taxes. And then Ben Wargle talks about Wisconsin basketball and the NCAA tournament. Looking forward to both of those. And coming up, we're going to revisit a conversation we had about the use of artificial intelligence in healthcare. That is next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. You know, artificial intelligence seems to be, and I think it actually is, pretty much everywhere these days. And we are going to take a look now at how AI is affecting healthcare. Larry Mueller here for WPR News, and our guest is Cheryl Goswami. Cheryl Goswami is UW Health Chief Information and Digital Health Officer, and recently UW Health hosted a roundtable in Washington, D.C., more than 30 leaders in government, healthcare, and tech talked about AI in healthcare, and I want to talk with him about why or what they talked about and how AI is affecting maybe your healthcare. What questions do you have about AI and its use in medical settings? Have you had an experience? Cheryl Goswami, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Good afternoon, Larry. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having us.
So why did UW Health feel it was important to have this roundtable discussion in D.C.?
Well, I think you said it very well in your opening comment. Everybody needs to know something or has an opinion about artificial intelligence. And as a leading academic medical center in the country and a pioneer in adopting this technology over a year ago with our colleagues at Epic and developing that software, we felt it was imperative upon us to be responsible leaders and work with our legislators and members of our executive branch of the national government to share some of the opportunities, some of the concerns, some of the shared risk and rewards that we in the healthcare provider area can gain working with our partners at the national government. Hence, we took it upon ourselves to build this coalition, if you may, of peers and had this round table.
So there were, I think, two discussion sessions, if I'm not. The first one was on the patient care and experience side of AI in healthcare. What problems is AI solving for healthcare systems? And I'll probably also ask you, what are they not solving?
Well, it's problems and opportunities both, right? So as everyone will agree across our country, healthcare staffing shortages are well documented. These shortages are impacting patient care. There is burnout. We are still having issues with staff. A lot of folks, our jobs are not being filled, so on and so forth. And so we look upon this as a form of where we can augment the human labor and try to start doing some work that technology can help do and reduce the burden on our provider and our care teams, which in turn leads to a better patient experience for our patients and their families. So that was the main aspect of the patient care and experience. And in my own words, I will say UW Health approaches this with the scale of how can we make our providers efficient? That's number one. Two, how can we do this with the right ethics? Ethics matter because we're dealing with personal data of our patients and providers. And three, how do we do this with an equity mindset to ensure that there is no further discrimination in any form across our patient base? And finally, the most important piece is technology is never going to replace the human in this ecosystem of providing care. So the empathy for which we all signed up to practice in healthcare should never be compromised just because there is a technology embedded in the process. And that's what we took to the table when we went to Washington, D.C. to say, how can we do all that in improving patient care?
Mm. John in Hayward has a comment that may relate to this. John, hello.
Yes. Hey, Larry, this is John.
Hi, John. What's on your mind?
Well, I'll tell you what, Larry, I am just scared out of my wits. That this AI is going to take over everything, you know. It just feels like robots taking over the world, you know, kind of. And I'm very scared of it.
You know, I bet you're not alone, John. I bet you, Jero, this is something you've heard.
100%, John, and I could have very well expected this question, and we should be scared to a certain extent, which is why leadership comes with responsibility, and I can speak from our perspective. Just because technology can do some things doesn't mean technology should do it. There is a right place and a right time for technology to be incorporated. In all the things that we have done to this day and for all our plans going forward, I use the line, the human in the middle will continue to stay. And so by having the human being, it is driving the responsibility of the technology and is also assuring our patients and providers that we are just not having a bot talk directly to the patient or take care of that. So that's what our position is. That's where I would say most responsible health systems across the country, most responsible vendors in the health system are taking place. Beyond that, there is always a possibility that, you know, people are going to abuse technology, which actually, to Larry's point, was the second part of the discussion as to where does regulation and the role of government come in sort of giving us some guidelines, some frameworks, and holding people accountable and responsible for their actions.
Yeah.
I hope that answers your question.
So, you know, typically when I think about AI, I think about, and I've had at least one online I think it was a Zoom meeting with my own physician, somebody I've worked with and known for a long, long, you know, practically my whole professional life. So it worked out fine for me. But I'm wondering, not there. So there's that aspect of talking with your physician or nurse or whatever online. In what other ways is AI being used in the arena of patient and healthcare?
Thanks, Larry, for that question. I think it'll be worthwhile to go back and look in a brief retrospective on the journey of AI. So AI has been around for a long time. I would say easily over 30 years. Artificial intelligence, in many ways, has been used in the healthcare arena and many other domains for a long time. Back in the day, where artificial intelligence could look at your data and predict that you may be at a certain risk to a certain kind of a disease or so on and so forth, and from the providers to take better care of you. AI has been around in our own personal lives for a long time. Self-driving cars have been around for a while. You've had, whether you're using an Apple phone with Siri or Google with Alexa or stuff like that, that's all some forms of artificial intelligence, which have been around for decades, if not years. Where we are talking in the last 15 to 20 months is where it has suddenly become to an expanded scale, where it is starting to use in conversational AI, in sort of what we call deterministic AI, and almost near real time, where you can now go to ChatGPT, ask a question, and it can tell you everything that you would like to know about it, which has made it very easy to do the right thing and very easy to do the wrong thing. I think that context of AI over the last 30 to 40 years is important, setting the context over here. From our perspective, the way I look at it, this is the first time we are going past data and numbers, and we're getting into emotions where we are talking about people's health. We are talking about, you know, people's outcomes, which is very different, and which is where John's question is very appropriate. It makes things risky. And it's become affordable. Until very recently, you and I could not go out and buy a server or a system that could do all these AI things. So suddenly it has become sort of mainstream. AI has broken all records over the history of technology in its adoption to the first million mark, which I think happened in 5 days. It would take years, years for Facebook or the internet to take over. So those are the things that we have to set in context, that the ease of availability, the affordability, that makes this a double-edged sword.
Yeah, it's there are some concerns. There, I actually, you know, I was thinking about the doctor's appointment. When I go to see the doctor, I've got to drive to see the doctor. I've got to park. I may have to, even though the appointment is for 10 in the morning, or 9 in the morning, I may have to, that may not happen right on at the appointed time. And you're suddenly looking at a fair amount of time involved for maybe a 20 or 30 minute visit.
You're right on. And COVID has exposed that possibility even further. And so at a broader scale beyond Madison, if you start thinking of rural healthcare, this is where technology can be a part of the solution to the bigger problem of accessing providers and health systems in a timely manner. I'm not saying it fits everybody's needs, and we live in an environment where a great deal of individuals still want to sit across the table from their provider and care team and talk to them. But for others, like a wellness visit or something more or less acute, a video visit could work just as well. And so used appropriately, technology should augment all of those, never replace any of those in that care setting. Time is a precious commodity. So if you're driving an hour, parking for 30 minutes, running late for 45 minutes and all of that, and you can do with a 20-minute appointment, absolutely, we can do that.
I'm wondering, to what extent is AI used among doctors?
So again,
you've got somebody, I don't know, where in some part of northern Wisconsin or some part of Wisconsin, and, you know, I'm not sure about this, or maybe I want to talk with some other physician about the same thing.
Yes. So this is like many other things. One size doesn't fit all. And so for many years, AI has been used more on the background or the back end of systems, where what we call decision support systems, where we look at your data and we prompt certain things, and the doctors can or cannot ask certain questions to get further information for your prognosis and diagnosis. That has been around for a while. Today, what it really helps is allowing us to help those physicians in Northern Wisconsin that you talked about have the expertise and exposure to academic medical center settings, sitting in Madison or Rockford, that can help the provider, 100 miles, 200 miles away, without having to transport the patient from that setting onto our health system in Madison, which in itself poses a risk to the patient. We tend not to force providers to use these tools. We do proof of concepts, because this is not just about the technology, it is the adoption of the technology. And just like a smartphone 20 years ago or an electric vehicle 10 years ago, not everybody moves at the same pace to accept all new things. Change management adoption is very key.
Chiro Goswami, our guest today, UW's Health Chief Information and Digital Health Officer, as we talk AI and healthcare. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Just wanted to mention, if you missed part of our show or just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archive at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of all of our broadcasts going back a long, long way. Let's take another call. Ralph in Green Bay, it's your turn. Ralph, thank you for calling.
Thank you. I just tuned in and I heard your guest talk to the point of an earlier caller being concerned about artificial intelligence taking over. I believe the comment was, but people are in between the artificial intelligence and what it can do and the results. My comment or concern would be, who's that person or people in between the artificial intelligence and what could they do with it? And what came to mind is the Hitler era, the Nazis. What if they had the artificial intelligence and they're the people in between society and what harm artificial intelligence could do? It's like, I suppose, a nuclear bomb or anything else. As we've seen today, rapid firing weapons, what they can do, and the weapons alone aren't the problem. It's the people, and how do you, when you have something as powerful as what artificial intelligence can and will be someday.
Yeah, how do you, if there's that bad, kind of a bad person, let's say, in the middle, I think that's a good point to discuss, Chiro.
Very, very good point. You can't have the fox guarding the coop, as the line goes. So in order to protect that very conflict of interest here, Larry, what we have done is in all our cases today, the human in the middle is a member of the care team, a clinician or a provider or a nurse. I want to be very clear about that. And allow me to get into a detail on the very scenario that we are playing out. And we're doing this at a very slow pace because this is not a race. Getting it right is important than being fast. So an example that we use is when a patient sends a message for certain kind of messages, and these are very low on the acuity or in the terms of criticality, the system generates a response. Every one of those responses is then reviewed by a member of the care team, not by a technology member, not by a member of the vendor, not by somebody sitting outside the shores of the United States of America. It is a UW health professional that reviews the message. And the individual then has a couple of choices. The person has a choice to accept the message, saying, this is exactly the way to answer the question. Yes, you should be able to do that, patient so-and-so, depending on the question. The provider may say, it gets the gist of what my answer is, but Larry Miller speaks a certain way. I am going to put a couple of my own words, a couple of my own sentences, so as to put my signature on it and add all of that. Or may come back and say, I don't like the answer this has been created, and deletes the whole thing. And as a human being would do, create it from scratch and put the response back and send it, which is why we have this thing called ethics that I touched on at the start of the show. By having a member of the provider team taking care of those messages, being a member who's responsible for the care of the patient, we are reducing the abuse that potentially the technology could provide. I hope that helps.
Yeah, it does indeed. I want to keep on that line, but I do want to make sure we discuss for at least a bit about the role of a little more about the role of government, as you discussed, in terms of regulating AI in healthcare, as you discussed at your meetings in Washington, D.C.
So on the role of the government, as we talked about, it has the potential, the AI has the potential to address some of our concerns with access. Larry, you're using your example. However, to our second caller's point, as we drive this innovation, we all know that the government also has to give us certain guidelines, frameworks, and I'll use the word protection, you know, from certain vendors and certain products. Using the very example of Hitler and Nazi, what happens if certain private companies go out and create all of this, and many of them can do it outside the shores of North America, and all of that gets embedded into the use in our environment without the protection, and not everybody may take the higher road that UW Health does in having that human in the middle to create that extra safety check, to have that high bar of ethics and empathy, and everything now becomes about talking to somebody else. Where does that go in terms of defining concepts and managing, you know, the bias and the accuracy that this technology can wreak havoc with? So that was a part of the conversation that we wanted our federal regulators to be aware that we need their support in the innovation, sustainment, and protection while we do this from our side.
Yeah. I wondered how the whole meeting went. Was there how did the conversation go on? Were there consensus on any of this, or?
So if you were to ask me what was the desired outcome of this conversation, and we were there for about 4 hours, and a couple of us met with individual members and staffers of the House of Congress, the primary purpose was to generate awareness. The primary purpose was to burst some myths, because everybody today has an opinion about AI, as you started the show with. And this was our way of saying this is not one health system, but leading healthcare systems, along with responsible partners like Epic, that are coming and saying, this is what it looks like from our lens. And while you make certain decisions, you need to just keep in mind that the patients in northern Wisconsin or southern Wisconsin are very different than the patients of northern California or southern California. So where does that national versus local governance play? And so with all of this awareness, the hope is we will publish some of our findings, some of the conversations. And this is a journey, and it was important to get the step to say, here's what we would like you to consider from our perspective.
Yeah. So you took away from this, you were happy about the results of that discussion.
I would say so, based on the feedback we received from almost 100% of the participants, that this was the first of many conversations that they have seen in this kind, because otherwise it's a very slanted approach where you have somebody selling technology, or somebody asking for a price protection, or somebody asking for, you know, carte blanche approval for something. So this was not lobby politics. This was presenting healthcare in its simplest form.
How did you land in the healthcare? I mean, you're obviously somebody who is very skilled and knowledgeable in this whole area, been doing it a long time. How did you land in healthcare?
Are you asking about me specifically?
Yeah.
Purely by accident. I did not grow up in healthcare. I worked in other industries, had a couple of, let's just say, less than fortunate incidents with close family members. And so about 18 years ago, when an option came up as to serve in healthcare, I thought I could go and, make a difference. And I will say 18 years later, it is the art of possible, where I can use technology to make a difference in making healthcare more affordable for the next generation. I got two boys. That's what keeps me in healthcare.
That's great. What are some ways that, or no, let me put it this way. What are patients likely to see now going down the road? What are some things that we might expect to see in the next few years in terms of AI and health?
So I would say, if we have a crystal ball, knowing that every 6 weeks, it feels like the outlook keeps changing. I think that in the next 12 to 18 months, the first set of benefits will be indirect to the patient as healthcare providers use this technology primarily to reduce the burden on administrative tasks. I stress on the word indirect because it is appropriate that we use the technology for less critical things, get those right first before we expose the risk to something directly in the care of the patient. So the indirect benefits may come in terms of, you know, quicker appointments, lesser errors in their bills, their prescription refills coming in faster, so on and so forth. There is technology that is being piloted or tested right now that also starts dealing with on the prevention side of the house. So how can I look at Larry Miller's, I hope you're okay with me using you as an example,
sure,
of your data, and say, Larry, based on all the data we have and the technology that we have at our disposal, you may be at risk for a certain type of a cardiac issue 3 years from now. So those are also the things in terms of prevention that can also help, in avoiding a visit to a hospital, which is difficult to start with, as you said. So this is a journey. It is about reducing the cost of healthcare today, which is significant. It is also about reducing the burden on the care provider who are getting burnt out. And if you don't have a physician today, it means a longer wait time for your patients, which means the patients also gain from that use of the technology. And most of all, it also actually does drive the safety and quality of care, which we often tend to forget in these conversations.
Some doctors I've talked with off, not on the air, have said, have complained about the amount of time they have to spend on on essentially it's paperwork, but it's not necessarily in a computer, but it's called paperwork.
Imagine the irony of that. And you're spot on. And you're spot on. I have had a resident back in the day tell me that I went to med school and I've become the fastest typist in my family. and it's unfortunate, but that's the world we live in. That all of this information needs to be typed in. Now, beyond AI, we are also talking about other technologies where how can we return the doctor back to the patient? How can we get the doctor to watch the patient in the eye versus looking at the keyboard? So there are other technologies that we are bringing to the forefront that actually captures the conversation between Larry and Chero, if you may, translates it into something that goes on the record that, again, the doctor, back to that second question earlier, the doctor that can then edit and make it accurate. So all of those things, in my way of saying, is it returns the care team back to the care of the patient and not all computer data entry operators.
Chero Goswami, thank you so much for being with us today. I hope we can do this again down the road. I appreciate it very much. Thank you so much for listening, and thanks to our folks that work here. Jeff Robbins, technical director, Lee Rayburn, another technical director, of course, Clara Neipert, Joel Patton, our producers, and Jill Nadeau, our executive producer. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store.